Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country. They have no basis in the Constitution. They have no home in our history or traditions. They've damaged the democratic process. They've poisoned the law. They've choked off compromise. For 50 years, they've kept this court at the center of a political battle that it can never resolve. And 50 years on, they stand alone.
Now, that is the Solicitor General of the state of Mississippi arguing for the rights of unborn babies before the United States Supreme Court earlier today. And this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk Radio, where you can join the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And as usual, naysayers always go to the head of the line. And on a day like this, where it seems very likely that the U.S. Supreme Court will end up deciding against abortion and in favor of life, I have a feeling I'm going to get more than a few of those naysayers. So, 866-439-5277. Just come with your wits about you, a few facts, maybe a little bit of logic, and if you want to defend killing unborn babies, I'll be glad to hear the argument. Emails go straight to me, talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in my Twitter poll, @LarsLarsonShow on Twitter. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website at LarsLarson.com. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the states of Idaho, Oregon, and Washington for more than 21 years. And a little bit later, I'm going to be talking to Alex Skarlatos, who seems to be the likely replacement for Congressman Peter DeFazio, who has announced just today he plans to go home after more than a third of a century in the House of Representatives and collect his pension, courtesy of we taxpayers. Back to the Supreme Court, though. The court watchers who watched what happened today and listened to the oral arguments before the nine Supremes, they say that the court seems inclined to uphold Mississippi's 15-week limit on abortion. Now, if you say a limit on abortion, how dare a state do such a thing? There are a lot of us who believe that the states should be in charge and should make the decision. And I would point out to you something that should concern you, whether you're liberal or conservative, whether you're pro-abortion or whether you're pro-life, this should concern you. When we have laws, and effectively America's abortion laws were made not by your state legislature, not by a vote of the citizens at the ballot box, not by the United States Congress, they were made by judges in black robes. Now, the question is, should you be able to do that? Should the Supreme Court be the supreme legislative body of the United States? It doesn't make any sense. We have a Congress to do that. If Congress doesn't want to pass a law on abortion, and if they say, oh, we want to wash our hands of that, and they don't want to trust the states to do it because some of the states are very pro-life, and God bless them for that, and some of them want to let you kill a baby for just about any reason whatsoever. Well, Solicitor General Stewart had this to say about that before the Supreme Court, again, just a few hours ago. Listen to this.
The Constitution places its trust in the people. On hard issue after hard issue, the people make this country work. Abortion is a hard issue. It demands the best from all of us, not a judgment by just a few of us.
Now, that's a pretty direct message to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think the court took it very favorably. Let me tell you a little bit of the background to this law. You see, when Mississippi said, we want to limit abortions to 15 weeks, there's still the right, I guess, if you want to put it that way, for a woman to seek an abortion to terminate her pregnancy and take that life that's growing within her. But the limit is 15 weeks. And there were liberals in America who said, oh, this is draconian. It's crazy. It's extreme. You know, an awful lot of liberals love to look at Western Europe, you know, all those nice countries like France and Germany and Italy and all those. And they want to say they have it right. Do you know that 15-week limit is more liberal in allowing abortions than 47 out of the 50 countries of Western Europe? If you want a comparison and say, well, we want to be like them, well, they have laws that are more restrictive than Mississippi's law. And I know that some of the antipathy toward Mississippi is probably born out of bigotry. You look at Mississippi and say, poor country or poor state, full of poor, uneducated folks. You know, we don't have to respect what they do. Well, here's what Judge James Ho of the Fifth Circuit Court, the appeals court that upheld the 2018 Mississippi abortion law, said. Nothing in the text or the original understanding of the Constitution establishes a right to an abortion. And Justice Clarence Thomas, my singular favorite justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, asked my favorite question. Exactly where in the Constitution do you find this right to an abortion? Listen to him ask the question and the answer he got back.
General, would you specifically tell me, state what the right is? Is it specifically abortion? Is it liberty? Is it autonomy? Is it privacy?
The right is grounded in the liberty component of the 14th Amendment, Justice Thomas, but I think that it promotes interests in autonomy, bodily integrity, liberty, and equality. And I do think that it is specifically the right to abortion here, the right of a woman to be able to control without the state forcing her to continue a pregnancy, whether to carry that baby to term.
I understand we're talking about abortion here, but what is confusing is that if we were talking about the Second Amendment, I know exactly what we're talking about. If we're talking about the Fourth Amendment, I know what we're talking about because it's written, it's there. What specifically is the right here that we're talking about?
And you know what? The people who believe in killing babies, they can't point to any part of the Constitution that says you have a right to take this life that is growing inside of you. And this is what concerns the liberals. They understand that they're up against it on this one. Chief Justice Roberts said, why isn't 15 weeks enough time? In his closing arguments, General Stuart of Mississippi reminded the court of its decision more than 120 years ago that found, believe it or not, Plessy versus Ferguson, that black Americans could be treated differently as long as they were separate but equal. It took the court two-thirds of a century to fix that mistake and treat all Americans equally, no matter their color. And Mississippi's Solicitor General said, this is the opportunity the court has today to correct that same kind of major mistake. Listen to his argument.
In closing, I would say that in his dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson, Justice Harlan emphasized that there is no caste system here. The humblest in our country is the peer of the most powerful. Our Constitution neither knows nor tolerates distinctions on the basis of race. It took 58 years for this court to recognize the truth of those realities in a decision, and that was the greatest decision that this court ever reached. We're running on 50 years of Roe. It is an egregiously wrong decision that has inflicted tremendous damage on our country and will continue to do so and take innumerable human lives unless and until this court overrules it. We ask the court to do so in this case and uphold the state's law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, General.
Now, I got to tell you something. This is why the court watchers are convinced this Supreme Court will say you're right. We made a major mistake with Roe v. Wade in the early 1970s. It is time to correct that mistake. And this is what has the liberals just absolutely scared to death, that we might actually get a Supreme Court that stands up and says, no, you can't kill that baby. Coming up, a special session of state lawmakers in Oregon to pay the rent for folks who claim they can't pay the rent in a state with 100,000 open and available jobs. And we'll talk to the man who might replace Congressman Peter DeFazio.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Yeah, I've got Alex Garlatos coming up in just a moment, and I think he's got a great opportunity to replace Peter DeFazio, but I have to get a couple of things done first. One, for the better part of 2 years, Democrat governors Kate Brown and Jay Inslee have claimed the dictatorial powers of royalty. But now Queen Kate has summoned the people's representatives into a special session of the legislature. But it's not to rein in the reign of the brown shirts. No, she's worried about thousands of renters, about 10 or 11,000, who face eviction because they're not paying the rent. No kidding. They're not paying the rent. They might be evicted. Can you imagine such an idea? Oregon has an unemployment rate of 4.3%, which is fantastically low. Good news. The state lists tens of thousands of jobs available for those who choose to work. Over the last 18 months, state and federal governments have shoveled out billions in extended unemployment, extra payments of thousands of dollars a month for a time to those without jobs, stimmy checks, kid care checks. You almost can't count all the money that got shoveled out. The state has already spent almost $300 million, a third of a billion, in rental assistance, and a small percentage of tenants have skipped out on about a year and a half of rent payments. And now Kate Brown wants $100 million more, maybe even as much as $190 million? Ronald Reagan always said the best social program in the world is a job. I want to suggest that in a state with almost 100,000 available jobs and wages at historic highs, if you can't find a job today in that environment, you never will. And if Kate keeps shoveling out the cash, why should you? Now, today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
You know, I thought I'd heard it all from the teachers' unions out there, but believe it or not, the Portland Public Schools and their teachers' unions, they say that the teachers are under all kinds of stress because of first-time in-person classes. So the union representing the teachers, and I'm not kidding, this did not come from the Babylon Bee, has proposed replacing in-person instruction with self-taught days for high schoolers once a week after winter break. In other words, they're working too hard. And they're saying, could you just have your kids teach themselves? I think the answer to that ought to be, yeah, we can. And at that point, why do we need you? The teachers' unions are about to walk their membership right out of the opportunity of having a job. I think it's insane, the idea that they say we have under-delivered to kids and under-delivered to the taxpayers who paid for that public education, and now we'd like a few more days off. Just tell your kids to teach themselves. I can't believe it, and I can't wait for the first naysayer on that. Today's best email, brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online, rivercityusa.com/careers. Please withhold my name, Lars. I'm in a politically sensitive industry. I heard your discussion with a naysayer about failed states. Oregon's a great example of a failed state. It overtaxes and overregulates citizens and businesses, yet instead of preserving liberty and prosperity, they actively interfere with it to the point of businesses closing or leaving to the tune of 50,000 fewer jobs than pre-pandemic levels. Vaccine mandates that negatively impact public safety, defund the police, letting criminals out on the street, the homeless problem, not enough hospital or mental health beds, riots, no bail, decriminalizing drugs, sanctuary state status, ignoring voter referendums, and even the state constitution. Feel free to add more to this list. The USA is headed there as well. Now, on that note, I'm really glad to have Alex Scarlatos. I called him on short notice because Alec has run before against Peter DeFazio. And thank goodness, the Democrat from Southern Oregon, DeFazio, has finally decided that a little bit over a third of a century in the House of Representatives is finally enough. So he's going to hang it up after this term of office. Except, Alec, I understand you've got one issue that has to be resolved. They haven't quite finalized the redistricting of the state of Oregon. You're not sure that you're still going to be living inside the district you want to run for, right?
Well, something along those lines. I mean, they have all but been finalized. We're just waiting to see the final decisions. But to be honest, I mean, seeing Peter DeFazio retire is a huge opportunity, not only for us, but really Oregonians as a whole. We have an opportunity because of, unfortunately, the Democrats redistricting. They've really bitten off more than they can chew, and they've drawn too many districts that just slightly lean Democrat. And the uninformed ballot, or the generic ballot, if you will, going Republican by about 10 points, that means that if that trend holds for 22, we could have 4 Republican congressmen represent Oregon and only 2 Democrats. That's huge.
It's gigantic. So, Alec, you've run before. You came very, very close to beating a sitting incumbent, longtime member of Congress. That's an amazing accomplishment. Is there any doubt at this point, other than the redistricting issue, that you're going to seek that office in the election next fall?
It's certainly looking like it more and more, and especially with DeFazio retiring. I mean, we came incredibly close. They made the district slightly more Democrat. However, in a year like 22, with no incumbent, it's a huge opportunity for us, and I don't think we'll pass it up.
And if no, I wouldn't want you to pass it up. I want to see you run for it. I want to see you win it. I want to see you represent Southern Oregon the way it should have been represented for decades and was not by Peter DeFazio. By the way, to be fair, we've invited the congressman on. He's been on the show before. Heck, he's one of the few members of Congress who actually has dropped an F-bomb on the show, which is kind of dangerous for me, but I don't think he can. Well, he did. We managed to bleep it, but he infamously did that. What are the issues you're going to present to voters that are going to persuade you that with this open seat, you're the man to fill it?
Well, really, it's what we ran on last time, and especially now there's going to even be more of a stark contrast. We're going to run on issues that are common sense. I mean, we saw what happened in Virginia. They ran on things like critical race theory and things where the Democrats have frankly just gone too far. We're going to be doing the same thing with local Oregon issues, things like forest management, things that, I mean, Peter DeFazio has really ran this district in the ground. I've mentioned it before, but the fourth was the poorest congressional district in the state after 36 years of Peter DeFazio. I mean, Democrats have not been good to the state of Oregon, and they certainly haven't been good to the fourth congressional district. We're just going to draw a contrast and run on common sense issues, less government, lower taxes, and common sense.
Is there any doubt that DeFazio is getting out now? He could probably, under other circumstances, run again, but he's looking at a Congress next fall. He's already had 18, he's the 19th Democrat to announce they're leaving the Congress. He's leaving because the Democrats are going to be solidly in the minority after next November.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a combination of the fact of he's not going to want to run an incredibly tough reelection. Even if he wins, he's not going to be the chairman of transportation and infrastructure because Republicans are certainly going to have the majority. I mean, he's also like 74 or 75. I mean, I think he's due. I mean, I believe in term limits. I don't think anyone should be able to serve in Congress for 36 years. So I think it's just long overdue, and we welcome it.
Absolutely right. Alec, I'll look forward to talking to you a lot of times between now and next November. That's Alec Scarlatos, who I think is the heir apparent to succeed and replace with a Republican name in the United States Congress, Peter DeFazio. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And as you know, conservatives try to be conservative. That is, we try to conserve things, which means when it comes to being environmental stewards, I think we do a pretty good job. On the other hand, I think the liberals who talk a great game about conserving resources and recycling and all that, well, they don't exactly manage to close the circle there, because in the city of Portland, there is a company, and I it's not just in Portland, it's a Seattle-based startup called Ridwell. I actually have to admire what they do, because they recycle stuff that isn't likely to get recycled any other way, things like light bulbs and batteries and stuff like that, plastic film. And you'd say, how would you go about recycling that? They've figured out a business model, and they made it voluntary, because if you want to sign up for their service, it doesn't cost it. It's $12 to $16 a month. And what did the city of Portland do, or the state of Oregon, or both of them in concert? They decided to try to put Ridwell out of business. Now, Aaron Mesh, who's the news editor at Willamette Week, as an editor, he has a sharp red pencil. He'll probably correct me if I got any of that wrong. But Aaron, is this the city of Portlandia, also environmental and green and all that, trying to put a recycling company out of business?
Yeah, hate to be the editor here, but no. The city of Portland's actually fairly enthusiastic and has welcomed Ridwell. It's the cities of Beaverton, Lake Oswego, Tigard, and Washington and Clackamas counties that want to get rid of Ridwell. So it's actually more conservative jurisdictions that are not very excited by this new company.
Okay, but it's all voluntary. If somebody wants to sign up for the service, what is it that's being threatened to be used against Ridwell to put them out of business? And did I get the business model right? I could pay
you've got the business model dead on. You're completely correct about the business model. Now, the question is, who does this threaten? Who would not like this? And the answer is trash haulers. Some of them are local. Some of them are national companies like Republic with $100 billion of infrastructure that they have to protect. $100 million of infrastructure they have to protect. And when you look at what Ridwell does, what it does is it takes a little bit of their market share away, and they hate that. And these trash haulers have contracts with the cities in which they operate that are exclusive monopoly contracts. And so the idea that someone could come in and offer an add-on service infuriates them.
Well, except that this is the part I don't understand, and maybe you know the numbers better. But what they recycle, I mentioned light bulbs, batteries, plastic film, plastic clamshell. Foam, clamshells, so the clamshell containers that are for the most part, I guess in Portland, I think they're illegal because that, of course, is the Green Portland area. If you took all of that out of the average trash bin, that's not going to reduce the total amount of garbage very much at all, is it?
0.0006 of the weight that's hauled to the dump by haulers. It's infinitesimal. It's such a small percentage that it's not actually possible to make a pie chart because you wouldn't be able to see the sliver of the pie. It's an incredibly small number. So why would trash haulers hate this so much? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that they're a clubby and extremely hostile crew. And, I want to be careful what I say on the radio, but who is in the sanitation consulting
business. Are they kind of mobbed up? Are you? Go ahead, say it. Say they're mobbed up.
I'm not going to because I don't think they are. But okay. there's a long history in Portland and the Portland metro region of trash haulers being extremely hostile to interlopers. And they say that this company is not regulated properly, and there's no way of knowing whether or not it's actually reusing or recycling the products it picks up. Again, logically, you wouldn't think that that's really that big a deal because the things that they're picking up are already going to the dump. So why would anyone care? There's a second reason, though, that I think is really important. And that reason is that all of these trash haulers have these exclusive contracts with the city and the other cities in which they operate. And those contracts set rates, and they say that everyone has to be served equally by these companies. Whereas Ridwell doesn't have to abide by any of those rules and doesn't have to serve anybody. It's a purely voluntary service, which means, on a business model, that Ridwell has a huge competitive advantage. And what freaks out these trash haulers is that someday, maybe soon, Ridwell may find a way to recycle something else that's going in the dump that is a major part of the trash haulers market.
What, they're going to figure out how to take kitchen scraps and somehow separate it from, because if you talk about weight and volume, I have to believe that they don't do cardboard, right? Or do they do cardboard?
I don't believe, they do not do cardboard, but I think cardboard's a great example of exactly the kind of thing that the haulers worry they'll figure out how to do. Like, the haulers look at the history of Uber and Airbnb, tech companies that were massively disruptive, that seemed like small things, that essentially destroyed the taxi industry just gone, and gutted the hotel industry. The hotel industry is obviously not gone, but it was badly harmed by Airbnb. And so I think these old industries, and trust me, as somebody who works in a legacy industry that is constantly threatened by new innovative ideas, I understand how this is scary. These old industries look at this thing and say, like, oh no, this is going to be another situation in which somebody has figured out how to deliver a service that we currently have exclusive rights to deliver and is doing it in a way that is not beholden to any of the things that restrain us. So that competitive advantage freaks them the heck out.
Well, let me ask you about this. They've insisted that this company has to get a recycling permit, even though Ridwell is not actually recycling. What they are is sort of they are the Amazon. That is, they go pick up all this stuff that can be recycled, and they transport it to whoever it is that's going to recycle batteries, light bulbs, plastic film, plastic foam, and all that stuff. They don't actually do any recycling at all. Should they have to get a recycling license from the proper authorities?
Totally fair question, and it's a question that currently both DEQ at the state and Metro are considering. So this is where the state regulators come in. Is right now Portland, the city, and I want to just be clear about this, not to give you a hard time, but Portland City Hall has been really enthusiastic about this. Who's not enthusiastic about this, obviously, are the trash hauling industry and a lot of the suburban cities that ring Portland who really don't like it. And there's different reasons why they don't like it.
What's the short reason they don't like it? Because I don't understand. All these other little, smaller cities like Lake Oswego and Beaverton, they're always telling you how green they are. Wouldn't you think they'd want to say, by the way, we even allow this company to go out and recycle stuff that would otherwise just go in the trash? Wouldn't they be glad to embrace that?
I genuinely think that they're concerned about fracturing their relationship with the haulers. I think they've received better lobbying from the haulers than Portland.
I know, but here's what I don't get, Aaron. The haulers, God bless them, are a service industry. They provide a service to the citizens of the city. Why are they suddenly saying, I'm afraid? It'd be like me saying, I'm afraid to go to the tire shop and ask for some service. That's what you go for. You go and you say, this is what I'd like. And the service provider provides it to you and you pay the price. Why are they afraid of a service provider? Although I could cite a lot of citizens who are now afraid of the allegedly service providing government agencies. But why are they afraid to offend the people who are supplying a service and making a lot of money?
That's a fair question. I think that every time that a disruptive industry shows up in a town, there's always a fight that takes place inside that town city hall about whether or not they're going to constrain that industry with a lot of regulation or let it experiment and try something different. Portland has decided to try something different. Beaverton has not. And I think that that's the distinction here. The flip side of this, which I don't suspect will be beloved on this radio program, is that what? Beaverton would argue that by not having regulation, you have no guarantee that the company is doing the things it says it's going to do. Plus, Beaverton mayor and the Tigard mayor really, really don't like, and this happens a lot with new companies coming into town, companies that don't kiss the ring, essentially, that don't come in and say, like, we would like your permission, we would like to operate, we would like to spend 15 hours with you telling you about our service. But instead, just kind of say, like, we're here and keep going. Remember, Uber came into Portland.
Meaning the free marketplace. Aaron Mesh from Willam Week, WWeek.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Glad to take your phone calls and emails. This has been a target-rich environment day. An awful lot of things have been going on. We've got Peter DeFazio leaving the United States Congress at the end of his term. That opens up a seat which I think should be filled with Alex Scarlatos. You've got the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments that even the court watchers say is likely to produce a decision in favor of life and against Roe v. Wade, correcting a terrible mistake that the U.S. Supreme Court made about half a century ago. And then we've got, on the local level, I've got a great victory for citizens, I think. Rob Anderson is with me, the author and the lead petitioner for what's called a mini-initiative petition in Clark County. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars. I really appreciate it. And I just got to say thank you so much for, I think, what was it, a week and a half ago, you helped us get the word out, and here we are. We made history yesterday.
I'm glad to see it happen. Would you mind explaining to my audience, who may not have heard, what a mini initiative is? Washington State has them. Oregon really does not. But it's a great little tool to get a public official, elected officials, to actually act when they won't act any other way. You say, we really want a vote on this. How does it work, and what did you manage to get put before the Clark County Commission?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So basically, the mini initiative, and it's Clark County. Every county is a little bit different. But in Clark County here, under Home Rule Charter, you can have a mini initiative, which is basically the people's way to walk into the Clark County Council and say, hey, we want this. We want you to vote on it. Because we did an online that did, like, I don't know, over 4,000 in 10 days, and they ignored it. So I did research, found out in Clark County we have this, and we got the, you know, it required 8,311 registered voters, but we turned in yesterday 11,505. I think that was the approximate signatures. So we're hoping that, you know, they're not going to, in fact, they can ignore it. They have to vote on it if we get the signatures validated.
Well, and I'm glad to see that, because I know there are times where citizens will call me and say, we're putting together a petition. I say, well, is the petition one that they have to act on? No. We just figure if we get enough signatures, that'll force them to do that. Well, it's well-meaning, right? But if you say, well, what happens when you get half the state to sign your petition, and the body you want to get, the legislature or the county commission or the city council, whatever it happens to be, says, yeah, thanks very much for the petition, and they throw it in the trash can. In this case, this is a way to say to the county commission, you have to vote on this. I'll bet you suspect that if they're actually pushed to a vote, they'll be forced, or they'll be compelled, to vote in favor of people's medical privacy. Tell my audience what this initiative would do if the county commission says votes yes on it, or you get a majority of yes votes on it.
Yeah, we just need three votes out of five, so it's very doable, considering that there's technically four votes that are Republicans. But what this would do is ban all, and it's real simple. It would ban all mandates that discriminate against someone's medical health status, i.e. vaccinated, unvaccinated, and really could expand to other things. And also that violates someone's right to privacy regarding health information. So that's the main focus of it. And I think it's a no-brainer. Last time we talked about this, it seems like it. Unfortunately, there has been some opposition, but I think it's really about not being educated.
Okay, so in this case, you think if this is put before the county commission, that these, again, four alleged Republicans, that they're going to look at this and say, if I vote no on this, I'm gone. I'm going to be either recalled or I'm going to be pushed out of the next election. So I have to vote on it. And the way they've avoided that up till now is just say, let's just not vote on it at all, because then nobody can say I voted against it. This actually says, no, you got to actually do this.
Yeah. In fact, so once it's validated, the auditor's office has 30 days to validate it. We believe that will be successful. And then it will go to the Clark County Council, where they have to set a public meeting. And then from that public meeting, they have to make a vote. And that's what I love about this. And just by the way, so the heat is turning up intentionally. The Clark County Republican Party last night passed overwhelmingly, I heard unanimously, in support of this, to pass it. All elected Republicans are to pass this and support it. So the heat is being turned up.
Now, so then we should expect to vote what? Perhaps next month, in the month of December?
I think that it's going to be, if it's going to be January 12th, roughly, that's the 30 days, okay. They might get it done sooner. But sometime in January, the meeting will be set. Now, Chair Eileen Quiring O'Brien has been our biggest supporter. So she's told me that she's going to set the meeting as soon as possible, because you could drag this out, obviously, as politicians sometimes like to. But she has said, we're going to move to a public meeting and that vote as soon as we can.
Does every county have the mini initiative?
No, I don't think so, Lars. It's very interesting. It's brought to us by the home charter rule, and I just don't know how many other counties. However, I want to, because I know your audience is broad, Oregon, Washington,
Idaho.
Say
it quick, because we're coming up to the break.
So go to our website, clarkcountygroup.com, because you could do something like this. It doesn't necessarily have to be an initiative process. It could be, having your council or commissioners do it.
I think it'd be a great idea. Every county ought to have the ability of citizens to say, we want a vote on this issue.
The sanctity of life. And I'm prepared to accept that the moment of conception is human life and being.
Yeah, that's Joe Biden about 6 years ago, back when he was vice president of the United States. And this is the Lars Larson Show. I thought that bite was kind of interesting. I'm prepared to accept that the moment of conception is when human life begins. Because, as we all know, Joe Biden is a good Catholic, except that he also supports abortion, because that's one of the requirements for being a Democrat in the United States of America. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you on board. And I'm glad to welcome to the program Richard Epstein, and welcome back to the program, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of law at New York University Law School, and a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor, it's good to have you back on the program. I take it you watched or listened closely to what the U.S. Supreme Court did today, as it heard arguments about this Mississippi abortion law that says the limit is 15 weeks. You can't kill that baby after that period of time. There are a lot of folks saying they think they know which direction the court is going to go.
Yeah.
Do you agree with the ones who say, yeah, it looks like the court is ready to say states can put limits like that on abortion?
I did not listen to the argument, but I've looked at the transcript and I've seen many summaries of it. I think, in effect, that the writing is clearly at this point on the law. The one way to do it is if you sort of look at the testimony of the questioning that comes from Justice Sotomayor in particular, and lesser so Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer. They're there for bear. They're fighting this thing as if it's a last-ditch battle. And you do not become so vehement in the way in which you put your case forward if you actually think that you've got the votes on the other side. So my sense about it is if you look at the way in which this case has particularly gone, that you're going to see somebody going back to the traditional view that the state has police power to deal with this. It's a kind of an interesting issue because it's not exactly clear what the grounds ought to be in this case. If you listen to Mr. Stewart, who was arguing for the state of Mississippi, he mainly made the argument, which is that this is something that's clearly ought to be left from soup to nuts to the state to legislate, which is also consistent with the view that the state could decide to reimpose all the Roe v. Wade conditions. But on the other hand, there's the kind of the philosophical question that gets raised is, when do you think that life begins? The quote that you made from Senator, the now President Biden, and the Catholic position is it begins with conception. I've always thought, whether you're religious or not, that has to be the correct answer to this. Yep. Why is that? Because every other change that takes place is gradual and accretive, whereas this particular change is discontinuous. Once fertilization starts to take place, the cycle is sort of on automatic, and you pick any other point in the area, there's just no strong line that you can draw. Viability depends on medical technology, to put it mildly. The time of consciousness is something that's going to be highly debated. So you want to do it, and then the issue switches to justification. Can you, as the mother, say you have special duties to take care of your child, as you do after birth, or do you have the right to treat this, as some libertarian thinkers have said, as a kind of a parasite coming into the body that she has the right to expel as a matter of right? I think the justification issues, as well as the institutional choice issues, are constantly going through this particular case. I don't think that there'll be agreement amongst the six justices who are likely to either overrule or put a big dent into Roe v. Wade as to which of these particular arguments, the institutional one or the moral one, ought to dominate. And I suspect there'll be a lot of further deliberation on that. But yes, I think the odds at this particular point are maybe there's a fractured court. But I think Roe is essentially certainly at risk at this particular point. Stare decisis won't carry the day, I think, with the majority of the justices who will come to the position that grievous moral error requires major correction.
Well, and Professor, that goes right to Solicitor General Stewart's closing comment, where he compared it to Plessy versus Ferguson and said, look, you had this decision. It was clearly, by today's standards, it was the wrong decision. And it took you 2/3 of a century to correct it. You should do the same in Roe v. Wade. Because when in Plessy versus Ferguson, when they said, yeah, you can have separate but equal, that's a legitimate way to treat people with different skin color, you finally realized and corrected the mistake 60 plus years later. You should do the same with Roe v. Wade. Do you think the court will find that argument persuasive?
I mean, you know, again, there's going to be a real division. That's an argument about institutional power and control, under which there was very strong moral consensus that the separate but equal line was just simply an excuse for racial domination. Yep. There's no issue of domination in this particular case. Abortion is a very strange issue because the only person who's entitled to take the life of the fetus, if it is a life, is in fact the mother. To give the idea of why it is that this is actually a serious issue having to do with birth and conception, just imagine the situation where somebody comes along, takes a woman who's reasonably pregnant, and beats her over the stomach in order to force an abortion. Under those circumstances, where it's done by a stranger, we would not just treat this as a harm to the parent or the mother. We would probably treat it as a harm to the unborn child as well and mete out the criminal sanctions accordingly. And so I think, in effect, that's the kind of puzzle question that we have. And unlike the consensus that you have in the Plessy v. Ferguson case, somebody can make the argument on the other side. This is the way America thinks. I'm going to give you the rough numbers. 2/3 of Americans think that abortion is immoral. 2/3 of Americans think that Roe v. Wade is essentially correctly decided, arguing that the morality is personal rather than social. So the question that you have to ask is, do you need the same kind of consensus that you had in Brown v. Board of Education that you have here? And then they're going to come back at you the other way. There are a bunch of southern states who argued in the opposite direction pretty vehemently. So every single argument that you made is plausible and refutable at the same time. Let me put it this way. There is a couple of cases which everybody now agrees are wrong. That is one of them. Korematsu, which was overruled by Justice Roberts. Dred Scott, obviously overruled by the 14th Amendment, the first clause on citizenship and so forth. And after that, the list gets very short. decisions that you simply regard as abominable. Many people would put Lochner against New York in that category, but here the ironies are just extremely deep. I always thought that Lochner was rightly decided. I think there is a liberty of contract, and there was no health and safety justification for telling people that they could only work under 60 hours a week. And there was a lot of evidence that this was an anti-competitive struggle designed to make sure that union bakers prevailed over non-union bakers, right? And then, of course, when you get to first to Griswold on contraception and then this, everyone's back in the substantive due process camp, which they had left. And Justice Sotomayor said it. So the question I'm going to ask, if you really believe in substantive due process, you want to overrule something, overrule Lochner. Because you don't have the health and safety issues that you have here, and they're not prepared to do it. So we never know from one day to another whether we love substantive due process or whether we hate it. And what this case has done is it's brought to the fore all the deep fractures inside the United States Supreme Court on virtually every issue of substantive entitlements that come under the Constitution. And my guess is they will continue to have disagreements, but the winds of change are coming. There may not be a single opinion amongst the six who vote to overrule. It is clear that the three liberals will not join in any such opinion. But I think it's more likely than not that this thing will be overturned. And I think it's more likely than not that the key voice on this would be probably Justice Thomas, who has always said in his version of originalism, if you get it wrong as a matter of interpretation, the Constitution prevails over the wrong interpretation.
Absolutely right. That's Professor Richard Epstein from New York University Law School. Professor, thanks for the time. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, and I want you to think about this, because sometimes we hear, oh, government is going to act on this problem or that problem. I don't think they're asking the essential question, and this could just as easily apply to Idaho and to Washington state as it does to Oregon. But Kate Brown decided, and the news came out yesterday, that the governor of Oregon, who has acted as though she has the powers and the authority of a queen, because she simply makes an order and it happens. She doesn't have to consult with the people's representatives. She's actually called a special session of the Oregon legislature. It's supposed to happen on the 13th of December. And you say, well, why do we need a special session? Is Kate Brown about to say, do the people's representatives agree with all these dictatorial edicts that have come out of the governor's office? No, she's not going to ask about that at all. She wants a special session of the legislature to vote upwards of $200 million to pay the rent for tenants who are not paying their rent. And if you say, hold on a second, the economy has improved dramatically over 1 year ago. I mean, last year we had unemployment rates in double digits for a period of time, and we had millions of people who were out of work. And of course, the country did a lot of things, I think, that were over and above what they should have done. But they said, we're going to give you unemployment. We're going to give unemployment to people who don't normally get unemployment, like the self-employed. Oh, and then on top of that, if you're on unemployment for a long period of time, months, we're going to give you an extra $2,500 a month. That's $600 a week. And then we're going to give you stimulus checks. We're going to give you all these various things. And we're going to do all this to make sure that you are, you know, preserved, that you are able to pay the rent, buy food, make sure all the necessities are met. They did all that. Oh, and they said, oh, and by the way, we're going to make it illegal for your landlord to kick you out if you don't pay the rent. And I think most people at the time assumed this will be relatively short. It'll be short-lived. And you say, oh, no, no, perish the thought. Government programs once created have, I think Ronald Reagan once said, they're the closest thing to immortality on earth. Is a government program. Once created, driving a stake through their heart does not kill government programs for the most part. So we shoveled out all that money. So everybody who's unemployed got unemployment payments, even if they ordinarily would not get unemployment payments. They got stimulus checks. They got the extra $600 a month or $600 a week for a period of time. They now get the child care tax credits and they get them in advance. You don't have to wait till you file your taxes to get it. And then we put up literally billions of dollars nationwide, and Oregon has spent almost $300 million on relief money for people who can't pay the rent. And yet there are still people not paying the rent. And a lot of us, I think, have asked a reasonable question. If you say, why aren't you paying the rent? Well, I lost my job because of the pandemic. Well, weren't you put on unemployment? Well, yes, I was on unemployment. And didn't you get an extra $600 a week on top of regular unemployment? Well, I got that too. And didn't you get a stimulus check? Well, I got that too. And aren't you now getting, many of you, child care tax credit money in advance at $300 per child per month? You're getting all that money and you still can't pay the rent? Well, Kate Brown and Jay Inslee said, and for a time, Joe Biden illegally said, you don't have to pay the rent. The landlord can't kick you out. Well, all of that nonsense is coming to an end. And now Kate Brown says, we've already spent $300 million on top of all the other money that I've mentioned, and now we have to vote another couple of $100 million for people who can't pay the rent. And I raised the question, I threw this out on social media as well this morning on both Twitter and Getter. I vastly prefer Getter. But I put it out and I said, listen, if you're in a state, Oregon, for example, or Washington, which is close by and has the same kinds of numbers, your unemployment rate is 4.3%. That's not quite as low as Trump got it down to, but it's a very healthy unemployment rate. It's very small. And you have, according to the state, I asked the state how many available jobs are in the state of Oregon. About 95,000 available jobs. Well, how many people are in trouble on their rent? About 10 or 11,000. And my question is, and I think it's a reasonable one, although some people I'm sure will say, oh no, you're being very unkind. My question is, if you can't pay the rent, do you have a job? Are you making money? And I had somebody on social media bounce back at me and say, hey, Lars, if those jobs pay enough to comfortably pay the rent. And I said, well, here's what I looked at. The minimum wage in the city of Portland is higher than for the rest of the state. The rest of the state is about a buck and a quarter lower. But in the city of Portland, minimum wage, as an example, is 14 bucks an hour. If you work a simple full-time job, 40 hours a week, and you will make at $14 an hour, if that's all you're making, although an awful lot of the jobs you might consider minimum wage are actually paying much better than that. I get examples on this all the time. I see them with my own eyes. I've had people email and call and say, Lars, nobody's paying $14 an hour. They're paying $15, $16, $17 an hour because it's so hard to get employees. But if you are only making the state minimum wage of $14, that's $28,000 a year. If you have a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a roommate, many of us had roommates when we didn't make as much money. I know I did for more than a decade after I left home. I had roommates well into my early 30s. Why? Because it was tough to pay the rent otherwise. So you say, okay, if you have a roommate and two of you share an apartment, what is your household income, assuming you only make minimum wage and you only work full-time? That is, you don't work a second gig, you don't work a side gig, you don't pull overtime, you don't have any extra income. Your household income will be only $56,000 a year, which is about $4,600 a month. And how much is an average apartment? Not the bottom end apartment, not the top end, but the average, $1,600 a month. That's the official number, using that as an example. Well, how come you can't pay the rent? If you don't have a job, get one. There are tens of thousands of jobs available. If you have one of those jobs and you're making only minimum wage, your household income between you and your sweetheart, your spouse, your significant other, or just your plain old roommate should be about $56,000 a year or more. Now tell me how, if you're grossing $4,600 a month, you can't afford $1,600 to spend on rent. That one doesn't make any sense. Well, I can tell you one reason. It's because Kate Brown and people like her will say, I'll just call a special session of the legislature. And they've got piles and piles of money. And after all, the state has already satisfied all the needs of the citizens. They've already repaired all the roads. They've well-staffed all the state agencies. I mean, I know none of that's true. And they're performing a bang-up job at everything, at education, at transportation, at everything else. Yeah, they're doing a great job. They have a couple of $100 million to shovel out for about 10 or 11,000 people who've said, they told me I don't have to pay the rent. I'm not going to pay the rent. Should a special session of the legislature vote for more money to pay rent for tenants who say they don't want to? Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com and is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday and always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Coming up in a moment, do parents have a right to know what the schools are teaching their kids, especially when it comes to critical race theory, discrimination based on skin color, sexual orientation, and all the rest of that? We're going to talk about that next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've told you that I think that America's public schools fail the kids miserably. I think that what happens is that they take the money from the taxpayers, and there's not necessarily any expectation that the public schools have to perform. They can have high dropout rates. They can have low performance numbers because none of it, like in the private sector, is actually tied to your compensation. No matter how bad a job you do, or good, you're going to get paid the same. So this has come to the fore, especially in the last year and a half during the pandemic, and especially with the emergence of issues like critical race theory. I thought we'd talk with John Riches, who's director of national litigation at the Goldwater Institute, which I admire highly, but I have no other dog in the fight other than that and an admiration for the late Barry Goldwater. John, welcome back.
Hey, appreciate you having me on, Lars.
So infamously, the guy who ran for and lost the job as governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia said, parents have words to this effect. Parents have no business saying what we teach their kids and what we do not. Do parents have a right to have a say? And do taxpayers have a right to have a say in what the schools, the public schools, are teaching the kids?
It's remarkable this is even up for debate. It should be a settled issue that, of course, parents have a right, both a moral right and a constitutional right, to direct the upbringing of their children. And parents and taxpayers have a right to know the operations of their public schools, what they're teaching, when they're teaching it, how they're going about their business. The fact that that someone would even question that real basic precept is somewhat surprising.
Well, and then we've got Nicole Solis. Would you mind telling me? We've actually talked to this young lady, and she seems like a very nice young lady who said, I'm just a mom. I'm not a political activist. I just wanted to know what they were planning to foist on my kindergartner, and what was the answer that she got, and what did Goldwater do to help her out?
Yeah, so Nicole's a stay-at-home mom out in Rhode Island, and she asked her superintendent, hey, what's my incoming kindergartner daughter going to learn in your school? And rather than answer that simple question, the superintendent directed her into this formal public records process. So she submitted the same questions through a public records process. And rather than answer those requests, the district threatened to sue her. And then the state affiliate of the National Education Association, one of the most powerful special interest groups in the country, decided to, in fact, sue her for having requested public information about the operation of public schools and what her daughter would learn in them.
How does that? And now, look, you're the director of litigation. I'm not a lawyer. How can you get sued for just asking a question?
Frankly, your guess is as good as mine. But what the union is arguing is that, they named her in the lawsuit because she requested these records, and they essentially have asked the court to stop the public records process. Now, look, I mean, there's a couple problems with that. The first is that they don't have any legal standing. They have no legal basis whatsoever to inject themselves into the public records process.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, for that, there's a records requester and there's the public entity. You know, the union has no ability to interject itself in that process, and they certainly don't have a legal right to name parents just for having requested this information. It was obviously just an intimidation tactic because they don't like these parents.
Well, I want people listening to this, John, to understand how dangerous this is, because if you chill the speech or the request, which are usually done in some kind of speech, either written or verbal, you say, I'd like some public records. Well, you're going to get sued, and you're going to have, even if you're right, And I think Nicole Solis was right. She was right to ask for the records, and it sounds like she was about to strike gold based on the reaction of the teachers' union. But if the teachers' union says, we'll sue you, we'll make you go hire a lawyer, you'll spend thousands, you could even spend tens of thousands of dollars defending yourself, and at the end of it, you're still not going to get the records, and you'll be thousands or tens of thousands poorer, and you may have a judgment against you in court, perhaps even one that effectively silences you. That's pretty intimidating.
Right. And I think that is the objective. You know, the process is the punishment. The union named these parents, only these parents, not others, at the moment, to attempt to make an example out of these parents. But look, I mean, this isn't going to stand. This lawsuit was baseless. It infringes on their rights to receive public information. And we've responded accordingly, and we've asked that the entire lawsuit be disposed of and that fees be awarded against the union for having brought this lawsuit first case.
Okay, so John, let's go to the more general question we started with, which is, what are the kids being taught? Do the parents have a right to know? And what's the best way for them to find out? Because I get lots of requests from parents who say, hey, my school appears to be teaching social justice, diversity, inclusion, and equity. Some of the, you know, they put 100 different labels on it, but it all seems to add up to the same thing. If you're a kid with white skin, you're part of the oppressor class. If you have black or brown skin, you're part of the oppressed class. And the schools are going to teach this, and they're going to lead kids or tell kids you should evaluate people, including yourself, based on your skin color. What's the best way for parents to fight back against this thing that they're actually paying for?
They need to be engaged, and transparency, I think, on this issue is key. So you need parents like Nicole that are willing to show up at school board meetings, that are willing to submit public records requests, open meetings requests. A lot of this stuff, you're right, the boards will try to hide it. They'll try to create other buzzwords. So instead of using critical race theory, they'll use something else like equity and things like that. But you know, requesting not just curriculum, but classroom lesson plans and what actually being taught in the classroom are ways around the districts and the unions' attempt to evade these sorts of questions. But it does require engaged parents who are out there and asking for this information and who are seeking to hold districts to a pretty simple principle, which is to be transparent.
Because this stuff is creeping into a lot of institutions, John, including ones that I actually like outside of education. Salvation Army is right in the middle of one of these right now because they came out with a big statement about how, you know, they had engaged in racism and that people who supported them had engaged in racism. And they were citing Ibrahim Kendi, who's one of the biggest pushers of the CRT nonsense. And the blowback they got from people, including me, was, I'm not giving a dime to you. And I love the Salvation Army. I have for decades. I've raised literally hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years for them. And I'm not doing it anymore. I'm not dropping a dime in one of those red kettles if they're going to push this kind of stuff. And they've actually withdrawn the statement, which tells me they think there's something wrong with it. But this is seemingly creeping in to major institutions, including some that are very beloved.
Yeah, well, like you, you know, I happen to believe America is inherently a force for good and is not inherently evil. I happen to believe people should be judged by the content of the characters, not immutable characteristics, including the color of their skin. But you're right. This is permeating, you know, with private companies. Fortunately, there is a market solution. You know, even nonprofits like you described, your donors can decide to take their money elsewhere. Customers can decide to take their money elsewhere if there's businesses that are propagating this sort of ideology. But when the government does it, when schools do it, you know, there is no market discipline there. And that's why we need transparency for schools and other government institutions that are propagating this so that we can hold political leaders accountable at the ballot box and elsewhere.
John, I appreciate the work you do for the Goldwater Institute. We're going to keep fighting on this one because I want people to know. And if the schools think this is all well and good that we're teaching your kids this, they should be willing to say, you're right, we're teaching them that, and here's what it is. If they're afraid to show it to you, then that tells me inherently that there's something wrong with it, and they know there's something wrong with it. That's John Riches, Director of National Litigation for the Goldwater Institute. This is one of the many nonprofits out there that have done some of the great work that we can't get our elected representatives to do for us. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And thanks for listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Dr. Fauci made an appearance at the White House briefing room today to talk about the first case that was detected of this Omicron, the variant that they've named after the Greek alphabet letter that allowed them to skip Z because it happens to be the name of the dictator of communist China. Take a listen to what Fauci says about that case.
So this is the first confirmed case of COVID-19 caused by the Omicron variant detected in the United States.
And guess what? The person they found it in is fully vaccinated and has mild symptoms. So you might wonder, why have they had such an overwhelming response to all of this? Because you've got one case, you've got it detected in the United States. It's in California. It's somebody who had traveled to South Africa, fully vaccinated, comes back to the United States, has the Omicron, which, by the way, nobody seems to have figured out whether it's Omicron or Omicron. Different networks are pronouncing it different ways. And if you want a little bit of humor that comes out of this, most of the television networks, at least the cable networks, have what's called closed captioning, where you're able to read the words that are being said on the program. If you if you've got hearing problems and you can't hear them, there's closed captioning. But closed captioning cannot actually hear Omicron very well, so they put in the word American instead. But all of this has led to a bunch of questions, including Peter Ducey from Fox News, who went after Jen Psaki, or went after Fauci today, and said, listen, when you talk about having everybody get vaccinated, because Fauci went right into the everybody has to get vaccinated mode, even though Fauci at one point said if we got to 70% of the people vaccinated, that we'd have herd immunity, that we wouldn't have a problem anymore. Now he says, no, everybody has to be vaccinated. And he says, especially everybody coming in from a foreign country. Well, the big irony that the White House isn't willing to admit is that while we're making people from Canada get vaccinated to come into the United States and people from virtually every other country on planet Earth, we have a southern border that has seen 2 million people cross illegally into the United States. And Peter Ducey thought he'd ask Dr. Fauci, how do you explain it if you say everybody should get vaccinated who's coming in from a foreign country? How about the millions of illegal aliens who are crossing our border with no controls whatsoever? Take a listen to that exchange.
Include everybody.
The answer is yes, because you know that the new regulation, if you want to call it that, is that anybody and everybody who's coming into the country needs to get a test within 24 hours of getting on the plane to come here.
Well, what about people who don't take a plane and just these border crossers coming in huge numbers?
You know, but that's a different issue. For example, when you talk, we still have Title 42 with regard to protection at the border. So there are protections at the border that you don't have the capability, as you know, of somebody getting on a plane, getting checked, looking at a passport. We don't have that there.
Now, I got to tell you something. Fauci is a master at baffling people with BS, and he just did it to Ducey. And sadly, Ducey has really stepped up over the last few years. He's become a much better reporter. He's usually the person that I see ask some of the best questions, but his follow-through is really weak. What I wish he'd ask Fauci is, you claim that Title 42, you've got federal law that gives you the right to have these people tested for whether or not they have COVID. I wish he'd just ask Fauci, if 2 million people have crossed into the United States, how many of them have you tested under that Title 42 authority? I think the answer is going to be pretty close to zero. We do know that some of them have been tested. I've talked to mayors from places like McAllen, Texas, who've said, we've got 20% of the illegals who've crossed in illegally, and they're being held in detention centers, including a lot of children, although a lot of those children are 16 and 17-year-old young men, so they wouldn't necessarily be considered children where they came from, but they are children under the law here, and they're sick with COVID, so why aren't you testing those people? I have a feeling that if Ducey had really pressed hard and said to Fauci, who heads up the agency and is the president's closest advisor on this subject of COVID, if he'd said, have you tested even 100,000 people who've entered the United States? And Fauci has to know the answer. And here's why. Because they didn't have anything budgeted last year to pay for testing or detection or vaccination or anything else on the southern border, because a year ago we didn't have this southern border problem. It was created by candidate Joe Biden, who ran around for a year last year telling everybody who'd listen, when I become president, we're going to let anybody who wants to come into the United States, and we're going to let them stay, and we're not going to put them in custody, and we're not going to hold kids in cages. Oh, they goofed on that one. Because, of course, the Biden administration today is holding kids in cages, just like the Obama-Biden administration held kids in cages during Obama and Biden. But if he'd really pressed Fauci to say, if 2 million people or so will have entered the country by the end of December, by the end of this month, how many have you tested? And I'm sure Fauci would say, well, I just don't have that number in front of me. Like Biden's energy secretary the other day didn't know how much oil America uses and couldn't even cite a number. I'll bet he would have said, I don't know. And if Ducey had been doing his job, he would have said, well, can you say you've tested half of them, 1 million? And I'm willing to bet the answer to that is no. As I said, I'd be willing to bet they have not tested even 100,000 of the illegal aliens who flooded into this country because of open borders, Joe Biden, and feckless Kamala Harris. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we intend to serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with a little honestly provocative talk. And you can be part of that conversation. And if you're on hold, we'll get to you eventually. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I'm kind of wondering, when the taxpayers of the Pacific Northwest states, and in this case, especially Oregon and Washington, not so much Idaho, they don't seem to suffer from this problem. But we've talked about the fact that both of the states have shortchanged hospitals by forcing the firing of doctors and nurses. They've shortchanged public safety by forcing the firing for vaccine mandates of cops and firefighters and paramedics. And now they've shortchanged the schools as well. Schools that have not performed very well at all over the last 18 months. And I would say government schools, because a lot of the private schools and the charter schools have performed just fine. They've made do and they've figured out workarounds even during the pandemic year and a half. But the public schools, they seem to continue to fail and fail and fail again. And now Washington State is facing a teacher shortage because of the demand by the state to teach critical race theory and because of the vaccines. Lieve Finna joins us now, director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center. Lieve, welcome back to the program. And if you don't agree with anything I just said, feel free to, you know, to object or correct me. But I just think at this point, when parents and community members who don't have kids in public school right now, I don't have any, my kids went to public school, but they're adults now. But I still care about the fact that we pay an amazing amount of money. You've talked about it before, $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 a year per kid, per kid per year to fund public education that just continues to disappoint right and left. What should we make of all that?
It's just, it's like you said earlier, here we've had a year and a half of COVID closed schools. Kids are seriously behind in their learning. And the first thing that we hear about when the schools reopen again is the indoctrination of children in this racialized, harmful, divisive thinking. You observed earlier, Lars, what are they thinking in the schools? Are they trying to destroy public education on purpose? I mean, it's very worrisome to me. The teachers are now saying that they are being forced to indoctrinate children in this idea that children can be reduced to the color of their skin. And if they're a certain color, they're considered oppressors. And if they're another color, they're considered oppressed, victims of our society, which is not true. It's a falsehood. So imagine putting yourself in the position of a teacher being told by their administrators, you must teach this now to the children. And the children start asking you questions back. What do you mean? What do you mean about that? It must be very hard for good teachers to have their their administrations say you must teach children to be racist. You know, you must segregate children on the basis of their race and undo, you know, the great progress we've made in this country and the whole, all the principles of, you know, equality under the law that our nation was founded on. Imagine the difficulty that honest teachers are having right now in the classrooms dealing with this. It's a moral issue.
It is, and you've pointed out that a number of teachers have, and God bless them for doing this, have just said, that's it. I'm walking away from this. I'm going to retire if I'm that far along in my career, or I'm going to go find a job somewhere else. I don't want to be part of doing this to the kids, and that's creating a shortage of teachers in the government-run public schools, right?
Yes, that is one of the factors that's contributing to the shortage of teachers. But there are lots of reasons for this, but I just recently heard a mother say that in the Seattle public schools, she's hearing from teachers that they've had it. They just are not going to imagine what they have gone through. You know, I mean, of course, it could have been done better. But, you know, a teacher trying to do her job or his job has had all kinds of obstacles placed in his way over the course of the last year and a half. And now this new obstacle, an ideological one. I mean, the schools are intended to broaden people's minds, not to narrow them. And this is a clear overreach by radical academics in higher ed that have somehow infiltrated our schools and are intimidating people into this wokeism. Everyone's aware of this now, critical race theory. It's in the schools. They call it all kinds of names to disguise it. One of the names they use is ethnic studies. Another one is social and emotional learning. Another one is culturally competent training, that kind of stuff. This is, make no mistake, it's clearly being done in the schools right now. And it is going to lead to all kinds of bad consequences, not only in the drop in of academic achievement, because you can see, Lars, they're spending time on teaching this racist, racialized nonsense instead of teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. And our history, they're teaching... Anyway,
to the point where, terrible. I don't know if Washington State has gone this far, but the state of Oregon actually saw the legislature earlier this year pass a law saying you don't have to be able to read, write, or do basic math to get a high school diploma. And a lot of us said, hold on a second. You've now said that you have underperformed for the kids during a pandemic year. We understand that. That's tough. You decided not to do summer school last summer when they could have. This last summer, they could have said, well, the kids have been shortchanged. Let's do an extra 3 months. Let's make up for that.
Right.
Like an employee at a company that performs badly, doesn't get the job done, and he tells the boss, don't worry, boss, I'll stay late tonight. I'll stay late tomorrow night. I'll get the work done. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. Not only that, but we want raises and we want more time off. And by the way, we want to teach this garbage to the kids when we're telling you we don't have the time to cover the basics, you know, reading, writing, and math. We don't have time for that, but we have time to indoctrinate kids that if you have white skin, you're bad, and if you have brown or black skin, you're oppressed and not much is expected of you. That's outrageous.
It is. It's outrageous. And it isn't just the high school graduation requirements that they're peeling back. They're going to be taking testing on as their target. They don't want to be held accountable. And the only means we have to point out that the schools are failing to educate children to the standard that the state sets, the only means we have are the test scores. And they don't like to be shown up to be failing, so they are now going after test scores. Of course, those are part of the oppressive, you know, the systemic racism in our system is done partially through test scores. I mean,
well, can you imagine this in any other job? I mean, if you had a car dealership and you said to your salespeople, how many cars you sell this week? Well, boss, we don't want you to consider that. We shouldn't be judged based on how many cars we sell. You go, that's the business we're in. How, you know, if you were somebody who ran a landscaping business and you said to somebody, how many yards can the average worker mow? And you go, three a day or four a day. You go, how many did Joe do? I don't know. And he doesn't want to be judged based on the number of yards he got mowed. You go, well, that's the business we're in. What are you doing? And yet I don't know if voters and taxpayers and citizens have just decided they have no control over the public schools. So they're just going to, hope for the best. And by the way, everybody gets a participation trophy. Leave, thanks so very much. That's Leave Finna from the Washington Policy Center. Coming up, I'll get to your phone calls and your emails. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk every single day. And today, target-rich environment. We've got the Supreme Court hearing a case that is likely to overturn at least the central function of Roe v. Wade, the idea that any woman anywhere in America can seek to kill her unborn baby as late in pregnancy as she wants, and that states may not set a limit on that. It sounds like the Supreme Court is about to tell Mississippi, yes, you can set a limit, and Mississippi's limit is 15 weeks. We've got the news from Peter DeFazio, member of Congress for more than a third of a century, who has finally decided to hang it up. I think he's fleeing the sinking Titanic that is the Democrat Party on Capitol Hill. Already 18 other Democrat members of Congress have said, I'm not running for another term. I'm not going to be around next year when we are solidly in the minority. So there's that going on. Then you've got this question, which is our Twitter poll today. Should a special session of the Oregon legislature, in this case, vote for more money to pay the rent for tenants who don't want to go get a job? Now, I don't think it's unreasonable to say if you need to pay your rent, you should get a job. And if you say, well, Lars, there aren't any jobs available, I'd point out to you that in both Oregon and Washington, there are tens of thousands of open jobs right now, many of them jobs for people who don't have a tremendous number of skills. And that even at the minimum wage, if anybody's actually paying the minimum wage, since I noticed that most of the fast food outlets that you might ordinarily think of as minimum wage jobs are paying well above the state minimum wage in both Oregon and Washington, even if you're just making minimum wage and you're working either one full-time job or a couple of part-time jobs that add up to 40 hours a week, you've got more than enough to pay the average rents in both Oregon and Washington, even in the biggest cities like Seattle and Portland. So, should a special session of the legislature vote for more hundreds of millions of dollars to pay the rent for a tiny number of tenants out there? The estimate is 10,000 to 11,000 people out of a population of 4.1 million or better. Almost everybody pays their rent, and there's a tiny group that is not, and they've been given rent forbearance for the last year and a half, many of them. They've been given extra stimulus money. They've been given extra unemployment, even unemployment for people who don't ordinarily qualify for unemployment. And then, of course, for a period of time last year, extra payments that totaled $2,500 a month. And then you've got child care tax credits on top of that and stimulus payments, several of those. So if you've got all that and you're still not paying the rent, tell me, for goodness sake, why? Now, to your calls. Let's start with Marvin in Seattle, listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Marvin, welcome to the program. What's on your mind? Marvin? Marvin's not there. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma instead. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey there, Lars. I've just noticed that they released the name of the shooter.
Yep, and, Crumbly.
I thought it was kind of ironic that they've already assumed that this is not one of the weapons that goes out and attacks Americans for no reason. I'm just wondering this is the first time we haven't had a trial, and they've come out and said that right off the get. Apparently, that they already know this guy. Is that kind of goes against the whole liberal agenda, doesn't it, about firearms?
Well, I'm not sure what you're saying. He's been accused. He has a right to his day in court. They know a lot of things about him. And frankly, I'm glad to see law enforcement. In many places, you have an incident like this, and law enforcement is not very forthcoming. They were in Waukesha, Wisconsin. They have been so far in Oxford, Michigan, where they've come out and they've told the public what they know about this young man. Where does that violate any kinds of ideas? He's still innocent until proved guilty, but they've told the public what they know about the incident that has now taken four lives.
Yeah, indeed, Lars. The story always changes. It perpetuates, and it just depends on the color.
No. Can I give you a warning, Ron? On any event, big or small, like this, the story is going to change because we learn more from day one to day two to day 10 to day 100. I mean, even 9/11 changed. 9/11 changed by the hour, and it changed for weeks and months after it happened. And if you say, well, I don't want the facts to change. I want to know what we know at that point. But what you're told today about a case that's still under investigation is likely to change by tomorrow and next week and next month. But if your complaint is we don't know all the facts right off the gate, well, that's the case. Let's go to Dean, who's a naysayer. Dean, we always put naysayers first. What do you and I disagree about today?
Critical race theory. And what my point I want to make real quick is that I think you're being disingenuous about how you present it, because, you know, critical race theory is a high-level legal thing that they teach in colleges and in law school.
Why are they now bringing it down to the public schools? Are you denying that it's taught in the public schools under various other names, as Lee
Finnis said?
Can you
tell me what schools they're doing taught it? Because I bet you can't name a school and a
Sherwood School District. Sherwood School District, for one. And there are dozens of others. I think it's being taught pretty much uniformly around the country. It may be a little less in the red states, a little more in the blue states like Oregon and Washington, probably less in Idaho. But it's being taught. I've seen letters from superintendents where they say this is part of our entire lens of how we look at every single subject of either diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's one name. Social justice, another name. Critical race theory, another name. But all of them come back to telling kids you are going to be evaluated based on the color of your skin, and you should evaluate other people based on the color of your skin. And you simply calling and saying, no, they're not teaching it. Well, the fact is, the evidence is they do teach it.
But that's exaggeration. They don't know. I'm not anything they are going to go that far.
Are you a
really
teacher?
Way out of line.
No. Let me ask you. I've always cite my sources. Where do you get your information, Dean?
I read a lot of varied things all the time. I'm a big reader. I see things all the time.
Okay, so you don't know anything directly. I've talked to people I just talked to earlier today, an attorney for the Goldwater Institute that is in court right now defending a woman. She happens to be in Connecticut, but she's just the mother of a kindergartner. And she said, I want to know what you're teaching my kids. And the schools have not only refused to let her see the curriculum, and she suspects that it is critical race theory. She's cited evidence that it is. And they say, we won't let you see it. Dean, doesn't it make you suspicious when public institutions say, we're not doing that, but we won't show you what we are doing?
Yeah, but don't you? I think you and a lot of your listeners are blinded by the white. You know, the fact that I'm not.
What does
a
that mean,
person,
Dean? What does blinded by the white mean?
You've just
thrown a racial term in. I want to know what you mean by blinded by the white. What does that mean?
It means you're just saying things about you say. I don't. How many times have I heard you and your listeners say, "Oh, I don't see any effects of racism." Oh, no, it's everywhere.
Well, no, when somebody can come to me and say, I was denied a job, and I come to find out, I got an email saying the reason I was denied the job is they said they won't hire a person of color. I'd go to bat for that person, and I have done that over the years. But when people tell me institutional racism in America, and we say, can you show us some evidence of it? Can you show us where that's happening and who it's affecting adversely? And they say, no, you can't see it, you can't hear it, you can't smell it, but it's there. And if you deny that it's there, then you're just aiding and abetting it. That's the kind of ridiculous nonsense we're up against, but thanks for a good naysayer call. Coming up, are states violating federal law when it comes to voter registration in our elections cycle and in the adherence to the rules of those election laws that all the states should be following? Welcome back, by the way. Tom, are you there?
I'm not hearing you.
Oh, you're not hearing me. Okay.
Oh, now I can hear you. How are you?
Okay, very good. Well, I'm doing well, Tom, but tell me about these letters that you've sent off to elections officials in 14 counties and 5 different states around America about whether or not they're following the National Voter Registration Act.
Yeah, they're a mess. You've got voter rolls in New York City, major counties in California, and out your way near Portland, Oregon. Where they're not removing names from the rolls as federal law requires. There's registrations in those jurisdictions totaling about nearly 12 million names. And over the last 4 years,
12 million?
They removed the grant.
Holy cow.
12 million names.
And now tell me this, Tom. What's going on here? Why would these counties and states, why would they say we're required to remove voters who shouldn't be on the rolls anymore, and they simply don't do it. I mean, in the day and age of computers, you'd think it'd be relatively easy to keep cleaned up voter rolls, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in New York City, you've heard stories about New York City. It's a terribly run voter system there. So that, I think, is probably the easy explanation. They just don't do anything that they're required to do if they're a mess. California, we've already been in litigation in California, and our experience is they haven't cleaned up the rolls in 20 years in many counties, or almost the whole state. Los Angeles County settled with us a lawsuit where they're in the process of removing up to 1.6 million names. I'm not quite sure what's going on there in Multnomah County, which is Portland, where they've had, they have 571,000 people on the rolls, and they've removed five of them over the last 4 years. I mean, that's a complete breakdown in the system that requires the names to be cleaned, the list to be cleaned. And what happens is, or what makes it all the more important, now that you've got this massive vote-by-mail push, it's urgent that the list be cleaned. It's urgent, and that's why we've warned these jurisdictions that if they don't clean up the rolls, we're going to sue.
Okay, Tom, for the people who are listening who are not as well-versed in this as you and I might be, explain why it's so critical to take these dead names off. People might be thinking, well, so you've got people on the list who used to live there, they don't live there anymore, and the name is just a dead letter. But in a vote-by-mail environment like Oregon has or Washington has, and most of the country seems to be moving in that direction, if you've got a dead name on the list, it still generates a ballot sent to somebody, except that it may not be sent to a real person. It may not be sent to a person who's still a registered voter. It just goes to an address, and it may be used for fraud. Is it fair to say that's the biggest concern?
Yes. I mean, that's the easiest way to commit fraud. You get these ballots being mailed to people who've moved away and they're misused. Or people could just show up because in these jurisdictions, I'm not quite sure about Portland, but I suspect they don't have voter ID there either. People could just show up and vote in someone's name. They don't need to. There's no ID requirement in large measure. So there, either way, it's an opportunity for fraud, which is why federal law requires that these jurisdictions take reasonable steps to clean up the rolls. And when they're not removing anyone, 12 million names in these jurisdictions, 33 removals over the last 4 years. And vote by mail already invites fraud because the voting's taking place away from government officials. And it's easy to commit fraud. It's easier to commit fraud. When you're mailing names to or mailing ballots potentially by the thousands to people who aren't there anymore, the temptation increases and the opportunities increase.
And Tom, I'd cite, I think it was an Arizona case, it might have been Nevada, where they actually recently convicted a man because he voted with his dead wife's ballot. And you'd say, well, how could he vote that ballot? You have to sign the outside of the envelope. Aren't they checking that? And I think the answer is they're not really checking them. They've set the threshold so low that if they have automated checking where a computer looks at the signature and says, yeah, that's close enough, that they let both this man's ballot go through and his wife's ballot go through. And then he gets caught at some point and they say, you voted two ballots. And they found him guilty. But how often are we finding those and actually detecting the fraud? And how often does it just go through and is taken as just another vote?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, for instance, you know, someone hasn't voted in several years. And what happens if there's an illegal vote made in that person's name? What's to alert anyone in an official sense that something improper happened? All they see is that someone voted. They have no idea that someone else voted in their name, which is why they need to make sure the lists are clean. And, you know, we've heard stories. I'm sure you've had listeners call in saying, Lord, look, my son, my daughter, they moved away to college 10 years ago. I'm still getting ballot applications for them here at home.
I am. I do get those calls. And I also get people who say, I got two ballots in my name, except they spelled my name slightly differently, but sent both the ballots to the same address. And I've had the elections officials say, well, we catch those. And I say, how do you catch them? And they say, well, If somebody actually gets two ballots to the very same name, exactly the same name, same day, date of birth, we'll catch that. I say, but what happens when, you know, Lars K. Larson gets a ballot to Lars K. Larson, my middle initial, and Lars Larson? You might see those as, well, that's probably a father and son with the same name. No, it's me. So there's no way from the outside to detect it unless somebody goes in and just says, hey, I got two ballots and I voted both of them, which people know is criminal, so they don't often confess to it.
As my colleague, he's an expert former attorney at the Justice Department, he leads our election integrity efforts, Robert Popper observed, 10% of Americans move every year. And so the numbers that we're talking about here, they should be generating tens of thousands of canceled registrations. There's simply no way to comply with the law while removing just 33 people. So when you talk about 12 voting lists totaling 12 million names, hundreds of thousands of those names shouldn't be there. And it is so disingenuous, frankly, on the part of politicians to push vote by mail, because they're the ones who know best that voter registration lists are notoriously dirty, because when they campaign, they avoid mailing them because it's a waste of money, because you're not getting the getting voters who are current.
No, and you can see it in the turnout, except you don't see it clearly enough. If they get 60, 65% turnout in a general election, they say, well, some people just chose not to vote. Or it could be that some people don't exist anymore. They shouldn't be on the rolls. And there is no reason for it. Tom, I'm glad you're doing this. Are you going to be able to get the courts to tell these states and these counties to straighten things out?
Well, for instance, we have a case in Los Angeles County. They settled with us. We had a consent decree in Kentucky. At least 250,000 names could be removed. And we've got cases underway already in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Colorado. This is not idle threats. And we have a record of causing cleanups as a result, A, of these letters, which would be great, B, any follow-up lawsuits.
And, Tom, what I want to see is I want to see reporters going to the people at those counties and at those cities and those states and say, hey, are you going to respond to this? And if you have a good reason to not clean up the rolls, tell us what that good reason is. Otherwise, clean them up and make sure you're not sending ballots out. That's Tom Fitton, who's the president of Judicial Watch. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls, including the naysayer calls, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. Getting some interesting email about my suggestion to you that the state of Oregon does not need to hold a special session of the legislature to further extend the eviction moratoriums, because all of the states of the Northwest have plenty of jobs available if you're willing to actually go and work. But if Kate Brown says, let's shovel out another literally $190 million in rent relief on top of the billions of dollars that have already been shoveled out, if you're one of those people who hasn't paid rent in a year or a year and a half, and you've been getting a lot of those checks in the mail, unemployment checks, extra money on top of unemployment checks, stimulus checks, child care tax credit checks in advance, why would you bother going to work if you don't have to? Because somebody, the governor or the legislature, has said, we'll pay your bills for you. Now, most of us find some real dignity and some quality in work. But there are people out there who, if given the chance, would say, if somebody else is going to pay my bills and tell me that I don't have to pay the landlord, then I'm going to take advantage of that. Let's go to Joe, who's a naysayer. Joe, you know that we always go to naysayers first. What's on your mind today, and what do you and I disagree about?
Hey, Lars, but two breaks ago, you said that you couldn't think of a single example of institutional racism, or that others could never come up with it. And I think the reason for that, and this is why I'm a naysayer today when I'm usually not,
okay,
is because those examples would be things like the 94 crime bill or, you know, Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood and all of these.
Oh, no, well, but hold on, Joe, within the context of the conversation, I was talking about things that are going on now. Margaret Sanger's long dead, thank God, because she was a eugenicist who aimed her killing activities at minority communities. She and her policies were actually inspiration for Hitler, not the other way around. And I'm not exaggerating that connection, which makes it amazing that so many Democrats like Hillary are proud of getting the Margaret Sanger Award, because they seem not to know that. And as far as the 94 crime bill, I don't think that was institutional racism at all. And do you know who demanded that 94 crime bill?
Joe Biden.
Not just Joe. Joe was hearing it from the community. He was hearing it from leaders in communities of color who said, listen, the drug dealers are shooting up our neighborhoods with guns. They're shooting up our neighborhoods with drugs. They're killing a lot of people. You've got to come up with some penalties that will actually shut this drug dealing down, which is one of the reasons that Joe backed that piece of legislation. I don't disagree with it. Do you think it was institutionalized racism to say if you're involved in certain kinds of drug activity that we've got to shut you down?
Well, I don't disagree with the bill necessarily myself, but I do think that things like where crack and cocaine, which are so similar, have different penalties. You know, the things.
But
like
you understand
that,
why? Do you understand why, Joe? I mean, there is a sensible, logical argument that if you say, does crack cocaine and are powdered cocaine and crack cocaine essentially the same judge just presented the same drug presented differently, and the answer is yes. Did the powdered cocaine business lead to people shooting up neighborhoods? And the answer was no. Other cocaine problem lead to people shooting up neighborhoods? That was the concern, was people getting dead who are just innocent bystanders in communities who got caught in the middle of drug wars.
Well, all drugs, you know, cocaine or crack cocaine, either or, is going to lead to gang violence, you know.
Not necessarily. That's not true, Joe. But if you want to assert that, go ahead. But at the time, the communities, especially communities of color, were telling the Clinton administration, listen, you got to do something. We've got people who are getting killed and they're not involved in taking drugs or selling drugs or buying drugs. They just happen to be the innocent bystander that gets killed by the gang wars that are going on over the control of those drugs. And like it or not, the powdered cocaine business was not generating those kind of gang wars, but the crack cocaine drug was. And so they recognized that in the law.
Well, crack cocaine indefinitely starts with the powder of cocaine. I mean, that's what they have.
I get that. Everybody gets that. But if you have a particular kind of drug that has created a collateral damage of gang warfare in neighborhoods where people get shot when they're just sitting in their living room, should you do something about the problem? And what you're arguing is, well, they made the penalties tougher for the kinds of crimes that led to people getting killed. Yeah, they did. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think the penalty for crack and powder cocaine should have been the same. I don't think that.
Okay. That's water under the bridge. Can you think of any current example of institutionalized racism in America?
Going back to Margaret Sanger, I'll say she's long gone, but we still have Planned Parenthoods in where? Minority communities within walking
mostly
distance. I mean, there's not a
most of the Planned Parenthood baby killing operations are in minority communities. They certainly are in Portland, they certainly are in Seattle, and you're right about that. But when they talk about
where I'm from, you know, but it's designed to limit and stop the, you know, minority communities' growth. That was the original intention.
That was what Margaret said. She wanted to exterminate people of color. And she said so. She said so in terms I can't even use on the radio today. Do you know that?
Absolutely. I do. She's a horrible person. But that's why I say these points are generally not brought by those who tout institutional racism and things like that, because it points back in the direction of the party that they're claiming will fix these things.
It absolutely does.
And that's why I say today I'm a naysayer, because, you know, there are examples of racism that came down the institutional pipeline.
Okay, but Joe, before we run out of time, let me ask you a simple question. Do you think little kids should be taught to evaluate their classmates based on the color of their skin?
Absolutely not. That's something I'm going through with my children's school system this year, you know, and they told me, I called to ask about the CRT, and I was, you know, the principal's a woman, and she said, oh, no, we just do the race-based, you know, the race-based.